Of course, I have come in contact with many variety of spirits, and some who claim to possess this divine love, but I never entered into any conversation or discussion with the master this question, as I was satisfied that they were spirits who had imbibed on earth the orthodox Christian beliefs, and were still possessed of the same, and that their claims to what they called this love, were based upon what might be called their beliefs in an imaginary, insubstantial something, which satisfied them, but which was not worthy of the consideration of spirits who had given their whole lives in the spirit world, to the study of spiritual truths, based upon the laws of the spirit world as they became known to the intellects of men, capable of studying and analyzing these laws, and the truths that they contained. I have many associates who devote their time and thought to the investigation of these laws and the truths that are deducible from them, and who are men, or rather spirits, who do not accept anything or declaration as a truth that cannot be proved by scientific principles and tests. We, of course, are not of a sentimental or transcendental kind, but confine ourselves to the pure and exact investigation of the laws that govern what we perceive to be the actual condition of spirit substances. But your conversation has made an impression on me, and perceiving that you men 508, are earnest in your discussion, and seem to have a firm conviction as to the truth of the fact that the souls of men and spirits may be transformed by this love, with which I am not acquainted, I commenced to think that there may be some spiritual truths that lie beyond the scope of the investigations that I and my companions may have given to spiritual truths. And so thinking, I should like to ask you some questions as to these matters, and if possible, learn if as a truth, there exists such a thing as this divine love as contradistinguished from the love that we all possess to a greater or lesser degree. So if you are inclined to answer my questions, I should like to propound to you a few at this time. Well, I have heard what you said, and I have asked if Professor Salyards is present, and a beautiful intellectual looking spirit comes to me and says that he is the professor and that he knows what you said and that it will give him great pleasure to answer my questions and to give me a full explanation of what this divine love is and the manner in which it transforms the soul into the essence of the Father. And he directs my attention to a number of bright spirits, and says that they are living examples of the fact of the existence of this love, and of the effect that it has on the souls of spirits who possess it. And he says further, that as the appearance of the spirit body discloses the condition of the soul, that if I will look carefully I will find an appearance in all these spirits that I do not find in spirits who do not claim to possess this love. And upon a careful scrutiny I realize that what he says is true. He invites me to a conversation, and I will go with him. I thank you for your consideration and will bid you good night. I was an inhabitant of England. Very respectfully yours, William B. Cornelis. I am here, Helen. Well, my dear, I see that you are tired and must go to bed, and I will not write very much. I was interested in the message that you received from the man who wanted to learn of the divine love, and he was very serious in his requests and seemed to have much pleasure in going with the professor, who will instruct him fully. Mrs. Stone was also very happy that she could write and tell the doctor of her love, and Kate was also serious when she advised the doctor to get married. It will undoubtedly be a wise thing for him to do, as the Paget messages 1917, well, as for you, as I have told you, your life is too lonesome a one. You need companionship. I was disappointed tonight that the master did not write. He was present in the early part of the evening, but the dark spirits were so persistent in their efforts to write, and so disappointed that they could not succeed, that the master thought it best not to interfere, and so postponed his writing. He will come soon. You are in good condition tonight for writing. I will not write more. So believe that I love you and love me in return and give me my kisses. You are a dear boy to treat me in that way. I was not in a hurry to sign myself. Your own true loving, Helen. January 31, 1917. I am here, Luther. I have come merely to remind you that I am waiting to continue my discourse to my people. I am very anxious to do this, and as soon as you get in condition I hope that you will give me the opportunity. Well, we will arrange that, and all that we desire is for you to get in condition. We are with you a great deal and try to assist you in every way possible. Well, you have asked me a question that I should like to have more time in which to answer than I have now. But in short, Jesus was not of the substance of God in the sense that the Catholic Church, following the Nicene Creed, claimed. He took on a part of the divine substance, as the divine love filled his soul, and so can you or any other man do to the extent that you may receive this love. But to say that Jesus was in his very being of the substance of the Father to that degree that made him equal to God, is erroneous, and should not be taught or believed in. He was born or created in the likeness of God in the way that has been explained to you and in no other. He was a man and not God, or any part of him, and if he had not received into his soul the divine love, he would never have been of the substance of the Father. But being of a very spiritual nature, and in fact so much so that he was without sin, this love commenced to come into his soul very early, as you may say, from his very birth, and at the time of his anointing he was so filled with it that you may say, he was of the substance of the Father in the quality that that substance possessed of the nature divine. He was no more divine though naturally, as I may say, than was any other mortal born of the flesh. I should like to write you a long message on 509, this subject, and will sometime, when convenient. Well, all the speculation that has ever existed as to the Eucharist and the change in the qualities of the bread and wine, are untrue. Jesus is not in these elements in any particular raw view that may be taken. His flesh and blood went the way of all other flesh and blood of mortals, and no more forms a part of the bread and wine than does your flesh and blood. This sacrament, as it is called, is very abhorrent to the Master, and when it is celebrated, I must tell you, he is not present, not only not in flesh and blood but also not in his spiritual presence. He dislikes any kind of worship which places him as its object in the position of God or as the Son of God who paid a great debt by his sacrifice and death. He wants God alone to be worshipped, and himself to be thought of only as the one who brought to light immortality and life by his teachings and the living demonstration of the truth of the existence of the divine love in himself. He does not approve of the teachings of men that his death and his blood were the means of man being saved from their sins and becoming reconciled to God. He says, it was his living and teachings and demonstration of the love of God existing in his own soul that showed the only true way to salvation. But, I must not write more now. So with my love I will say good night. Your brother in Christ, Martin Luther. I am here, Saul. I have not written you for some time and I would like to say only a few words, and these are, that never in all the battles with the Amalekites, did God help me or bring to me victory, as is set forth in the Old Testament. Although some of the prophets, like Samuel, at the time might have thought, yet as I now know, it was not true. God was not the partial and particular patron of the Jews, and to him it was just as sinful for the Jews to commit murder and the other horrible crimes that are mentioned in the book in connection with my life as king, as it would have been for the pagans to have done the same thing. God is not the God of any race, but he is the God of every individual child who comes to him in true supplication and prayer, seeking his love and help in his spiritual nature. God will respond and the individual surely will be helped. But should that individual come to him, seeking power and assistance to murder his fellow man, no matter how great an enemy he might be, God would not help him or approve of his desires, and this being, the Paget Messages 1917, so, you can readily see that he would not help any nation to commit such acts and gain the victory. And I want to tell you here, that God is not a God of nations, but of individuals only, and only as the individuals that compose the nations, can he be said to be a God of nations. He wants not the praise of men or of nations because of victory that they might acquire through bloodshed and cruelties ascribed to his help, but he wants the praise of men only because their souls may have been awakened to his love, and have acquired victory over sin and evil. Nations rise and fall and disappear from the face of the earth, but the individuals who compose these nations never die, even though the physical bodies die, and God is a God only of those things that never die, and he is interested in having the individual become victor over sin and the appetites of the flesh. Of course, The individuals make the nation and give it its character and qualities, and hence the nation will become sinful and cruel as the individuals that compose it become sinful and cruel. He does not deal with nations as such, but only with the small, but important, units that make the nation. Hence, for a nation to say that God is our God, or that God will help us to victory over our enemies, is all wrong. When the individual gains the victory over his greatest enemy, himself, then he can claim that God is his God and give him the praise, and when all the individuals of a nation have gained that victory, then that nation can proclaim that God is its God and render to him praise for the victory. But only in such event is any nation justified in saying, God is our God. And here let me say, that no Christian nation, so called, has yet, as individuals, attained to that condition of righteousness and victory over sin that it can claim to be God's chosen nation. And so I say that I, Saul the king, before my alleged fall from the grace of God, was no more helped by God, than I was after that supposed event, for the reason that while outwardly I may have appeared to seek God's directions and listen to the advice of his prophets, yet inwardly, I was no more in accord with him or reconciled to him than I was after the momentous event. God never helped the Jews, as a nation, to any greater extent than he did any other nation, for they as individuals were no more in attunement with him than were many individuals of what were called the pagan nations. When I went to Samuel in my despair, as the Bible portrays, and felt the burden of the sins of my life, I became nearer to God than I had ever been before, and he was more my God than ever, though I did not realize it. I merely write this to show men that they must not believe and rely on the statement that because I was said to have observed God's will and obeyed his commands before the time that I realized defeat was certain to be mine, that God was any more my God then, directing and assisting me to overcome my enemies than he was after that event. I have written enough and will now stop. So with all my love, and the assurance that God is a God of the individual and not of the nation, I will say good night. Your brother in Christ, Saul. I am here, George C. Calvert. I was an acquaintance of yours when you were a student at Newmarket, and you will recollect me when I recall your memory to the fact that I was called Judge. Well, I came, because I saw that other spirits were writing you, and when I looked at you I remembered you, and then desired to write. I am in what is called the dark plane and have been for some time now, though when I first entered the spirit world I went into the hells and suffered a great deal. But I am thankful that I have gotten out of the conditions that suited me for those places, and am now in a brighter plane and in less suffering. I don't know that you can do anything for me, but some spirits say that you have helped them, and if that be true I should like for you to help me. I am willing to do most anything to get into a better condition, and if you will do what I say, I will appreciate it very much and try to follow your advice. No, I should like to be surprised. Well, I have looked, and I see some wonderfully bright and beautiful spirits, but I don't recognize any of them. Wait a moment. One is coming to me and I am surprised, for it is Professor Sayers. How wonderful! Why, he is really handsome. Well, well, dear old professor, he says he is glad to see me and that I must go with him, and I certainly will. I thank you very much and will come again. Good night, your old friend, George C. Calvert. February 1, 1917. I am here, James G. Blaine. I want to write a few lines as I am interested in the affairs of our 510, the Paget Messages 1917, country, and I see the present critical condition of affairs growing out of the recent declarations of the Germans as to the policy that they intend to pursue regarding the blockading of the ports of the Allies, which means, in substance, that the ports of our country will also be blockaded. For if the merchant vessels traveling from the U.S. to the ports of the Allies are not permitted to land at their destinations, there will, of course, be no departures from our ports, and the result will be the same as if such ports were actually blockaded. It is a serious condition for Mr. Wilson to deal with, and he must act quickly and firmly, and not in any particular recognize the right of the Germans to carry out their policy, or to permit, so far as possible, the cessation of the travel of ships from our ports to those of the Allies. Temporizing will not do, and he must at the very start let the Germans know that America will not submit to the dictation, and that, If necessary, the American nation will not only sever diplomatic relations with Germany and her allies, but will become active participants in the war, which humanity and the welfare of the majority of the nations of the earth demand shall be recognized and enforced. He, the President, may in his dream of peace, which he has recently given expression to, and which is wholly impracticable at this time, attempt to conciliate the Germans, and by further reasoning show them that they are wrong and violators of all recognized laws of nations, and this hope to avoid war, or the involving of America in this conflict. But to do so, will constitute a great mistake, for his protestations will fall on deaf ears, and create in the German mind the impression that his great desire for peace will restrain him from asserting to the extent of force, the power of the US to prevent the Germans from carrying out their policy of murder and destruction. I write this, not because I am in any way antagonistic to the German people, or have any special predilection for the Allies, but because I see the right of the matter, and that which is necessary to the salvation of not only the larger part of the nations of the earth, but also to preserve the rights and dignity and substantial welfare of the US. This action of the German nation must not for a moment be tolerated, and the sooner the President strikes the better it will be for all concerned. Of course with the Germans it is a matter of life and death, but even so it is not right that the other nations of the earth should suffer ruin or destruction in order that the German nation should continue to exist, and be enabled to carry out its 511. Policy of domination, which is really the foundation of the existence of the present war. While I am a spirit and supposed to be interested only in spiritual things, yet my thoughts and interests are with my people, and incidentally with all the nations and peoples of the earth, and these nations and peoples must be preserved and not be permitted to be ruined by any other nation, and especially so in the present war for which no justification exists. For the course that the Entente have pursued in attempting to carry out its unholy desires for destruction and aggrandizement. I know what the rulers of the various nations contemplate and what their policies are in the prosecution of this war, for I visit the councils of each of them and learn the thoughts of the leaders, and the objects of their efforts and desires. On both sides there is much that deserves condemnation and entails suffering. But in weighing the wrongs perpetrated by these various nations I realize that the Germans are guilty of the greater wrongs, and if God should interfere as the Kaiser and the rulers of some of the other nations believe he will, the German nation would have visited upon them the just indignation and punishment of that God. But he will not interfere, and men will be left to themselves to settle this war, and they alone, but here I may say that as right and justice are more powerful in the long run than wrong and injustice, the nations that have the most of right on their side, will come out victors. And according to my understanding of the things and motives and ambitions that have entered into and caused this war, the Allies must become the victors. Of course, I cannot tell when this war will end, but considering the conditions that exist and the causes that are now operating, I believe that the end is in sight and that very soon the Germans and their Allies will have to sue for peace, and the end will soon follow. I would like to write more tonight, but your wife advises me that I have written enough, and so I will close, so good night. Your very dear friend, James G. Blaine. I am here, Bismarck. Let me say a word, as I have listened to what has just been written, and am interested in the subject matter of that communication, and do not agree with the sentiments or the conclusions of the thoughts that contained. I'm not impartial, I confess. But yet I, the Paget Messages 1917, think that I can do justice to both of the contending parties in the war, as I am a spirit and have learned that right is right irrespective of the person or nation that may claim to be in the right in its actions. I was a German, and a rather important one, as men consider important in the earth life, and was acknowledged by the world to be something of a statesman. I have kept in constant touch with the thoughts and motives of the leaders of the various nations that are engaged in this great conflict, and know the right and wrong of things to a great extent, I claim, than does the spirit who has just written you, and submit that my inferences opinions are as worthy of consideration and acceptance as are his. In the first place, this was not brought about by the Germans without justification and cause. And for a long time the German rulers delayed and endeavored to postpone, and, if possible, avoid the war. But their rights, as a nation, were so seriously preyed upon and not recognized, that the only thing left for them to do was to compel their secret enemies to respect their rights by force of arms, and so you have the real cause of the conflict. The Germans were not desirous or ambitious for conquest or territory or advancement to the detriment of other nations, but only for what they, as a great nation, were entitled to. And England, in its greed, stood in the way of and prevented these rights from being recognized, and tried every way in her power to prevent the German nation from enjoying these rights, and especially from extending its commerce to countries in which England had established her commerce and trade, almost to the exclusion of every other nation. The Germans waited in hope that by diplomatic means their rights would be established and recognized, but such hope was never realized, and as a last and only resort, they threw down the gauge of battle, quick and sharp and destructive, with some violation of the rights of a neutral that stood in the way of accomplishing what the German nation considered its decisive blow. But this is history, and it is not necessary that I should further detail it now. As the war has progressed for more than 2 years, Germany has naturally become depleted of its resources, and especially in those things that are necessary to sustain the physical existence of its people, and all through the action of the Allies in preventing foodstuff and other necessaries being imported from other nations. Its ports have been blockaded for a long time, and it 512 has been unable to obtain supplies that were absolutely necessary to the existence of its people, until famine and want are staring them in the face, and more than that, have actually worked their ruinous effects, and the cry of the people is for sustenance. Then, such being the fact, what is the duty of the German rulers? Can humanity ask that they shall sit supinely by and see their people starve and their country ruined, because of the conditions that I speak of, brought about by their enemies in preventing intercourse with outside nations? I know that international law should be respected by nations in war as well as in peace, and that it is for the good of all nations that such laws be held sacred and inviolable, and Germany has tried to observe these laws, even after some of its enemy nations have violated them. Let me ask here, what difference does the means used in considering the right or wrong of a thing make when the same result is accomplished? England, by her superior number of war vessels, has succeeded in blockading the ports of Germany, and preventing its people from getting the supplies necessary to their sustenance, and at the same time is enjoying the benefits of unrestricted importation of these necessaries, because Germany had not had it in its power to blockade the ports of England and thus prevent her from obtaining these supplies. This kind of blockade, the nations claim, international law justifies, no matter what the results may be. And now, when Germany has found a way to accomplish the same thing, as regards the ports of England and place her and her people in the same condition that the people of Germany have been in for so long a time, and are given notice of its intention to use such means, the nations hold up their hands in horror because such means are not known to international law. The effect of one blockade is just the same as the effect of another, then why should the means make any difference? America has not been permitted for a long time to send its products to a German port, and to that extent its, America's have been blockaded, as the last writer says, but this is allowable, because, as they say, the English blockade is in accordance with recognized international law. All which means, that because one nation has the power to do a thing in accordance with international law, another nation has not the same right because the means used are not contemplated by that law. The Paget Messages 1917. Well, such reasoning is one that if applied to the progress of the world would have kept that progress in a state of stagnation. When international law was formulated, the means and instruments used in this war were never heard of, and they are only the evolution of the war, growing out of the progress of man in the knowledge and necessities of war. Laws are always subject to change, and that change need not be by agreement, for sometimes, and it has often happened, necessity has compelled and justified the modification of the law. It is said that necessity knows no law, and it is a truth, and one that has been recognized and applied by many nations, at many times. In the present circumstances of Germany, This necessity has arisen to such an extent that the very existence of Germany, not only as a nation, but of her people as individuals is involved, and life is at stake, and the only remedy is that the nations who are fighting Germany, be placed in the same position as she is in, and that can be done only by preventing those nations from obtaining those supplies that are necessary to maintain their people, and this can only be accomplished by blockading their ports. It may be said that the use of submarine is brutal and inhuman. Well, for the argument admit this to be a fact, yet it is not necessary that any brutality or any murder be actually inflicted, for if the persons interested will heed the warnings and not attempt to run the blockade, there will be no murder or outrage. And why, may I not ask, is it not just as reasonable to demand that the blockade established by the German submarines shall not be attempted to be violated as that the blockade which the English have established shall not be attempted to be violated? In the latter instance, the neutral nations recognize the blockade and do not attempt to have their merchant ships enter the ports that are so blockaded. And why is there any greater injustice done when Germany demands that these neutral vessels shall not enter the ports that she intends to blockade? The only difference is in the means used, and if the neutral nations will observe the obligations that each blockade imposes to the same extent, there will become no necessity for using the means in either. I do not see why the US should feel that her rights are being violated to any greater or different extent, as a question of right, by the proposed German blockade, than by the blockade that was 513, been created by the English, and for so long a time existed. Of course, the effects of the two blockades upon the business of the US are different in degree, as more business is done and has been done with the Allies, than was done with Germany. But this does not enter into or affect the question of the right or wrong of the matter. Well, I will not write more along this line. Now, as to the results of the war, or rather as to its ending, I cannot prognosticate. Germany is fighting on very unequal terms, and she may be defeated, and I would not be surprised if such was the end of the conflict. But, nevertheless, and even though victory may come to the Allies, I assert as true that the right of the matter is with her, and that the neutral nations are not doing her justice, when they declare that she is the aggressor, and that she is not justified in the course that she is now pursuing. I am told that I have written enough, and so I must stop. But what I have said is the right of the matter. Good night. Your friend, Bismarck. I am here, Helen. Well, dear, you have received some very interesting letters tonight, and both the spirits who claim to write actually did so. Blaine is very much interested in the crisis that has arisen, and his advice is given with much enthusiasm and desire that the President take immediate action to protect the rights of the U.S. Bismarck was most serious and not at all excited while writing, but was very calm in stating what he considered to be the right of his country. Well, it is all very sad, and we spirits, as well as you mortals, will be very glad when this cruel war is over, for I must tell you that many spirits come over from the battlefields in a very bad condition, and the spirits who receive them are given much work to do in helping them. I have visited some of the battlefields during the battles and have seen some very terrible sights, and sometimes I will write you the results of my observations, and what the spirits of some of the soldiers have said and done after they were in the spirit world a little while. Peace will come, but never will it be a certain lasting peace, until men receive in their hearts the true love for their brother mortals. The reforms must come to the individual, and the victory of nations as such, will not bring this peace. Well, you are tired and I must not write more. But I must say that you are in a much better condition of spirit and soul, and if you continue to the Paget Messages 1917, pray to the Father, you will soon be in condition so that the higher spirits will be able to write their messages, which they so much wish to do. We all send love and blessings and desire you to be happy. You know how I love you and want you to be happy, and how my prayers go to the Father for your happiness and the inflowing of the love. So think of me and love me, and have faith and courage, and you will be blessed. Give me my kiss and say good night. Your own true and loving, Helen. February 5, 1917. I am here, Luke. I merely want to say that you are in better condition tonight, and that I will write a few lines upon a subject that may be of interest to you. In the spirit world there are many spirits who are in neither darkness nor light, but are in what has been called the twilight zone, and are neither very happy nor unhappy. These are spirits who have progressed from the lower spheres, where they expiated their sins and errors of the earth life, and have gotten rid of their recollections of many of their sins and have progressed somewhat in the development of their natural love, and also in the acquirement of the intellectual knowledge, and are not feeling the stings of conscience, but are realizing the happiness which the forgiveness of their sins and the improvement of their intellects causes them to have. They are to a large extent very much in the condition of men who have paid the penalties of their sins, yet have not received such increase in their natural love as to enable them to progress to the higher intellectual spheres where the spirit becomes to a more or less degree the perfect man.